Good morning, 7:42 here on the Mighty 690, and it is time for our chat with folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. And joining us, we have Holly Miner. Good morning, Holly. How are you doing?
Good morning. I'm doing really well.
Good deal. No, it's nice to have you in here. A little bit of a cloudy start to the day, but we've been enjoying the rain for sure.
Yes, and the weather's, the temperature outside is really nice right now, so go outside and enjoy it.
Yeah, absolutely. So we, you know, it's always a good time for cooking, you know, and that's, I know, what we're going to talk about today. You wanted to, I know you have a couple events and that sort of thing coming up, but first you want to talk just a little bit about kids in the kitchen.
Yeah, so a lot of parents are looking for things for their kids to do during the summer, and everybody needs to eat, and we want to make sure that we're preparing healthy meals. And so there's lots of things that you can do with your kids while they're at home over the summertime, and cooking is one of those things. You know, with very small children, you can have them wash vegetables, scrub vegetables in the sink, help set the table, maybe stir a salad together, or some make Jell-O or something like that that's easy for them to do and that they would enjoy doing. And then as they get older, you can work with them with some different kinds of skills. So maybe you start letting them cut bananas with the table knives and learn how to read a recipe or look at a recipe or pick out foods that they want to eat together and try to plan a menu with them. So there's different things as they get older, and then when they've developed some of those skills that they've are able to do on their own, then you can add some different things in, like using a vegetable peeler or a grater, learning how to break eggs into a bowl. All those kinds of things are things that we can do with children as they're growing and developing their skills in the kitchen.
Well, and some of these skills, you know, for some of us, it's been a while since we learned them. It's just, it's almost, you kind of have to think back and remember, oh yeah, this has to be taught. But you know, the other thing is, this can actually kind of help you out in the kitchen when you're busy preparing a meal. You know, once they're setting the table correctly and they've got it all down, you can just ask them, hey, can you set the table? And that can help you out as a parent just to get things done a little faster, one less thing that you have to do.
That's right. And then as they get older, it's always really nice to come home and have one of your children say, hey, I made supper, or I made a salad for supper, or I made dessert for supper tonight. So it's always good to have that be told to you when you get off work from a busy day. I know I enjoyed that when my kids were able to do that when they were younger. So.
Well, sure. And, you know, I know that there are some cookbooks out there that are geared a little bit more towards kids, and that can kind of help to spark their imagination and get them to make something that's easy, and they can get some satisfaction out of that as well.
Yes. One of my coworkers was telling me about a cookbook that she had gotten for one of her children, and they were getting ready to prepare a recipe. So, you know, it's and her children are very young, so it's never too early to start working with your kids and teaching them skills. These are skills they're going to need throughout their lifetime, and when they learn that early and they develop that love for working with food and being in the kitchen, then we're hoping that by developing those skills early and learning how to cook and prepare things from scratch, that they'll eat healthier as they get older and they'll have those good habits.
Sure. And I know that each individual kid is different. Is there any kind of guidelines out there of maybe, you know, what tasks can be perhaps recommended at different ages? Of course, you know, you have to know your own kid, but is there any publications or that sort of thing out there on that?
I'm not aware of any that are available through K-State, but I know a lot of the children's cookbooks will have things that are very basic, and as you look through those books and you know your child's level, like you said, it's kind of an individual thing, so each parent can make that decision as to what skills they think their child can do. And I've had children that were younger than 8 years old be able to use really sharp knives and do a really good job with it and not cut themselves. So, you know, it does depend on the child.
I'm sure. Well, since, you know, we are talking about this topic of having some kids in the kitchen, there's a good opportunity coming up with the Kitchen Kids Camp, right?
Yeah. So we actually have a program called Kids in the Kitchen, and there are four opportunities for them to participate in a children's cooking class or a youth cooking class. It will begin at 9 in the morning and go until 11:30, so 2.5 hours. We prepare a recipe during that time, and the kids will learn some of those skills that I was talking about earlier. The classes are all free, and there is a first-come, first-serve basis for signing up. There's a registration form that needs to be filled out, and that's online, and we can get that to anyone that's interested in that. All of our camps are in June. They're all on Tuesday, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. So June 6th through 8th is in Fredonia. And we have actually, I'm looking at my schedule here. We've got 6 openings available in Fredonia. The Neodashe camp is actually full right now, so I'm not even going to tell you when that one is because it's full. There's a camp in Oswego, and that is June 27th through 29th. And I have 4 spots available in that camp. And then there is a camp in Coffeeville, and it is June 13 through 15. And there are 4 spots available in that camp. So get signed up right away. Get your children signed up. This is for children ages 10 through 12. And we will be learning how to grate. We're going to be using vegetable peelers. We're going to be whisking things. We will also be cooking things on the stove, so we'll be working with boiling water and cooking pans on hot plates, and we will also be using sharp knives. So the kids will learn all sorts of things on how to chop, dice, slice, cut, grate, whisk. All those kinds of things. We'll also read a recipe, so they'll be able to read and understand a recipe, and then we talk about nutrition in the class as well. So there's lots of things that we'll be doing in the course of the 3-day event. The last day is, I think the last day is really fun, and the kids really seem to enjoy it. It's a little cook-off competition, and so they create a menu. During the first 2 days, they work together in teams of 4, and they create a menu, and then on the last day, they have an hour to prepare that menu and present it to some judges for review, and it's fun. They really get into that, and it's neat to see them working together because they're communicating together, they're discussing things, they're thinking about what a menu should look like. We talk about color and temperature and texture as we're planning our menu, and we also talk about including all of the food groups. And so those are all things that the kids take into consideration when they're planning their menu. They work together as a team to be able to prepare that food. So there's a lot of skill development besides the cooking skills that they're learning in the class as they go through that as well.
Well, that is really good. Where is the camp here in Coffeeville going to be?
It will be at the First United Methodist Church.
Great. Well, that is really good. And, you know, space enough to have the kids spread out and being able to use the facilities and all that sort of thing. So that is really good. If people are interested in signing up, I know we, like you said, we do still have some spots left. Not a ton, but we have some spots left. Mm-hmm. What's the best way to do that?
They can give our office a call at 620-331-2690, or they can go on our website and look for Kitchen Kids on the events on the right-hand side of our website, or they can look on Facebook under Wildcat Extension District and look at an event on that, and the flyers and stuff will come up, and there's a QR code that they can scan and do the registration, complete the registration form online.
Very good. Now we got the kids in the kitchen event. Is there anything you have cooking-wise for adults?
There is something that we have for adults. So this year we're trying something a little bit new. I'm pretty excited about it. Just like the kids get an apron, the adults will get an apron that come to this class. So that's another free thing, another fun thing for them. We are having a Cats in the Kitchen. Consider that we are wild cats. So, yeah. And it is for adults ages 18 and up. And it will be held on Thursdays in July and August, every other Thursday, starting July 6th and ending August 31st. That camp will be, or that program will be, from 6 to 7:30 in the evening, so we can accommodate people that may be working. It will be held in Neodesha, and it is also free. And we'll be preparing different foods throughout the sessions. There's 5 sessions. 2 in July and 3 in August. You're encouraged to come to all 5 of those sessions. We will have incentive items or items to give away to the people that attend those sessions. So I received some from one of our sponsors the other day, and they're very, very nice rubber spatulas. So there's a set of rubber spatulas. There's also a dough scraper. So a couple of different things there that will be given away to the participants in that class. The some of the topics we're going to talk about are double duty meals, preparing meals quick and easily, and then maybe making a few extras and then being able to take them to work for lunches or those kinds of things, or even preparing ahead of time and then maybe freezing them and then putting them in the oven and baking them when you get home from work at night, so that they're quick and easy meals that can be prepared ahead of time and then used later. We will also be doing a chopped competition for the adults. So the very first session, we're going to jump right in and do a chopped salad competition. So we'll get to see some of their skills right off the beginning of the class. And then one of the last classes that we will have, we'll talk about herbs and spices and how we can use those to season our dishes and maybe stay away from some of the fats and the salts, and use the herbs and spices to flavor our foods.
It is really amazing what you can do with just a little bit of spice to really make that dish stand out from something else.
So yes.
That is really good. So you said it's the same kind of sign-up process on that. You can head up the website and you can call on that.
That's right. Yep. And that the registration for that just opened this week. So we will get that out to everybody. I haven't really advertised that class much yet, so there's right now I have no one signed up, and I've got space for over 30 people, so that's a great opportunity to get involved in that program as well.
That is really good, and I know lots of people out there looking at maybe picking up a new skill, a new kind of hobby, whatnot. That is going to be a really good option. It can't be the price.
That's right. That's right. Thanks to some great sponsors, the American Heart Association and Stay Strong, Live Long Wilson County has been very supportive of the programs that we do in Extension, and provided the funding to be able to offer these classes for free. So we really appreciate that.
Fantastic. Well, Holly, anything else we should know this morning?
Well, if you have any questions about food preservation, I'm here to answer those for you as well. Had a lady call in just yesterday and wanted to know if we tested pressure canners, and yes, we do.
Yeah.
So bring your pressure canner into one of our 4 offices in Girard, Altamont, Fredonia, or Independence, and we'd be glad to get those tested for you.
This rain is making those gardens grow, and people are starting to think about, well, how do I save some of this?
That's so right. There's nothing better than open up a home canned jar of food in the wintertime.
Absolutely. Yep, you can preserve that sunshine for the gloomier days of winter.
There you go.
All right, well, Holly, appreciate you coming by as always, and I look forward to chatting again here real soon.
All right, thank you.
And we got Jesse Gilmore. He's going to be coming in here in just a few minutes on the phone, so we're going to be chatting with him before you know it. 63 degrees right now in Coffeyville with news coming up. 810 here on the mighty 690 as we continue our chat with the folks at K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. And on the line, we have Jesse Gilmore, horticulture agent for the district. Good morning, Jesse. How you doing?
Good morning, James. I'm doing pretty good. Had to deal with some ticks this weekend, which is what we're going to be talking about today when I went out to Knobnoster State Park in Missouri. It was pretty rough time, and I understand a lot of people are having problems with that too.
Yeah, you and I both. I was at Fall River State Park actually this weekend and went through, I mean, it was just a short section of trail, and I got probably between myself and the dog about 6 or 7 ticks going one way, about the same number coming back, and my folks were with me, and they were, got them on them and their other dog, and I mean, it was just ridiculous. And then, I mean, just yesterday, I was just walking the dog and went through a little bit of high grass there, and I picked two ticks off him just like that. So I've been talking with folks here. They're saying it's the worst tick here that they have seen in a long time. So I'm glad that other people seem to be noticing that as well.
Yeah, when I was on my way home from Knobnoster State Park on the Missouri side, I ended up picking 16 ticks off of my dog, and I ended up with, I think, 3 on myself. So it was not really all that fun for any, well, it was fun for my dog, but she did not realize she was getting totally attacked by these parasites. So yeah, ignorance is bliss, I guess. But today we're just going to talk a little bit about what ticks are, why they seem to be so bad this year compared to previous years, and some things you can do to protect yourself from tick bites, and what to do if you do end up with a tick on you.
Very good.
So ticks. Oh, go. Sorry.
Oh no, so this is fantastic.
Not actually insects. Much like spiders, they've got 8 legs and an exoskeleton, so they are arachnids. However, there's a lot of insecticides that will also work on ticks, and we'll touch a little bit on that in a bit. But ticks go through quite the reproductive cycle, because much like insects, they serve as prey for a lot of different animals. And so they need to combat the early death of individuals with laying more eggs and having more nymphs. So that is one reason why the population always seems to be pretty bad for both insects and for ticks, is because they're trying to combat individual loss from predation by animals like birds. Opossums in particular are very voracious tick eaters. They will eat about 5,000 to 6,000 ticks a year. So that's one of the good things about possums. Possums get kind of a bad rap, but they keep the tick population in check pretty good. So that is one reason why ticks seem so bad this year. The other reason that I would put forward, and I don't have solid research on this, there's been anecdotal evidence that I've found that kind of gels with this, is the fact that it's been such a dry spring. And you see this with insects too, and it really depends on the insect, and I'm going to put forward a example of what I ended up going through with the Colorado potato beetle. But when weather deviates from a norm, that either delays or speeds up the life cycle of specific insects and other pests. So back in 2015, I was working at a urban farm in Kansas City, Kansas, and I was responsible for pest management of this farm. It was organic, so I had to look at the damage that insects were doing to the vegetables and determine if it was economically worth trying to control them with the organic insecticides and organic pest control methods that we would need to use. And the Colorado potato beetle was feasting on the tops of potatoes. And what we ended up seeing is the Colorado potato beetle emerged pretty late in the year. So they emerge as the weather heats up, but that particular spring. We had an unusually cool and unusually wet spring, and that delayed the emergence of the adults from underground to feed on the potato tops. So the fact that they waited so long to emerge actually made it economically not worth it to control them, because by the time they started feeding on the potatoes, the tubers, which is the part that you eat from the potato, had already grown to their full size, and we weren't losing any yield from the Colorado potato beetle feeding on the foliage. So it was not worth it. And the timing of the emergence is because they need to overwinter underground, and they emerge once they are reasonably sure that it is warm enough to survive. So the fact that the cool spring happened made them think that potentially it was going to cool down or just not be survivable enough for them. And we're seeing kind of the opposite of what happened in that particular instance this year because of how dry it's been comparatively this past spring. So we kind of didn't really have any general easing into the really warm temperatures. It was kind of a light switch instead of a dimmer switch. We had really cool temperatures, and then suddenly we had really warm temperatures with not a lot of rain. And so that made everything become active all at once. And so that's why we're seeing a lot of tick activity in the more natural and wild areas of the four-state area.
So, Jesse, I was just going to ask you. So, the ticks that I have been seeing are the big ones, like the I believe they're called dog ticks. But also, I've seen some really, really tiny, tiny ticks. And I mean, I know what wood ticks look like, but to me, these look like maybe immature nymph ticks. I'm not sure. Is it possible to still kind of encounter those out and about, the ones that just haven't gotten big yet, or do we actually have those smaller wood ticks in this area? Do you have any idea on that?
Yeah, so ticks go through incomplete metamorphosis, which is where you have smaller. There's two types of metamorphosis. There's complete and incomplete. Complete metamorphosis is where you go through a very where the bug or arachnid goes through a very drastic change, and the adult form looks nothing like the larval or the pupal form. That's going to be your butterflies, but most of the pests that we deal with are incomplete metamorphosis pests. And so the nymph form will look almost identical to the adult form, just in a smaller size. So the way to think about incomplete metamorphosis is like you are getting rid of clothes that don't fit you anymore, and you are trading up into a pair of jeans, for example, that fit. The bug or the arachnid is going through the same thing. And I would say that most of the time when you are seeing small ticks on you, they are nymph forms of regular, adult ticks. And you actually run into more problems with nymph ticks than you do with adult ticks in terms of potential tick-borne diseases like Lyme disease. There was a research project done by A.T. Still University in Kirksville, Missouri, where they asked people to send in any ticks that they collected in the state, give their location where they believe that they got the tick, and they tested for four different diseases that ticks are known to spread. And what was interesting about that is that in Southwest Missouri, where I sent in most of my ticks, that seems to be the lowest area of tick-borne disease prevalence compared to the rest of the state. It also, not necessarily that it's the lowest tick population in the state, but it had the lowest number of submissions. So that could be just people not submitting the ticks. It could be because there weren't as many ticks to submit. I know I sent in probably around 6 or 7. But Lyme disease is the most commonly known tick disease And there are a couple of things you can do to minimize your chances of tick disease, both for you and your pet, just so that you don't have any ill health effects from the tick. And the most problems that you're going to have with the tick are mild discomfort and possibly phobias, but not anything physical health related. So when you're out in nature, there's a couple things you can do. The first is to wear long clothing. And that's not necessarily the most appealing option, but I guarantee I would have had way more ticks this weekend if I did not wear long pants. Long shirts are not as important because most of the time when you are walking through brush that is going to have ticks on it, it's going to be moderately tall grasses. It's not going to be huge plants that you're going to rub with your arms or anything like that. It's probably better safe than sorry to wear long long shirts or long tops, but if you had to pick one or the other, long pants are definitely the way to go. If you do wear long pants, it's usually a good idea to tuck the legs into your socks so that if ticks do get on you, they don't have a way under the legs of your pants to get onto your skin. I did not do that, and that's how I ended up with one tick on my leg. And the last thing that you can do as far as prevention goes is to use a DEET insecticide or a permethrin insecticide. Now, these insecticides aren't going to kill ticks. They are going to be repellents because of their strong odor, and that strong odor signals danger to the tick. So they avoid areas that have these sprays because of the scent. So DEET, very common insecticide. You can find that pretty much anywhere. Walmart, Home Depot, Orscheln, places like that. That is an insecticide that is safe for use on skin and on clothing. If you do the technique of tucking your pant legs into your sock, you're usually not going to get any on your skin. It's going to be all on clothing, but you want to spray that about 4 inches up your leg, around your ankle, and on your shoes to really prevent almost all ticks from getting on you. If you do find a permethrin insecticide instead, which also a tick repellent, that is something that you do not want to spray on your skin. That is for clothing only. And you want to make sure that after you go out and enjoy nature, that you want to wash those clothes and get the permethrin out of it. If you had one or the other, there's not one that's usually more effective than the other at preventing ticks. They both prevent ticks about the same. So DEET is what I would recommend just because, you know, there's no harm in getting it on your skin as opposed to permethrin. So that's how you can prevent ticks on you. Obviously, avoiding tall grass or unmaintained brush will also go a long way towards preventing ticks, but sometimes that's just not possible in the place that you're going to go. You definitely want to, when you get home from enjoying nature, check for ticks on you. Ticks like moist places, so they're going to usually target places like under your arms, in your armpits, around your groin, under your socks, on your feet. Places that they can get a lot of moisture, and usually places that they can hide. So it takes a really thorough checking because some of these ticks, like you mentioned, are nymphs, and they are very small. There are also much smaller species of ticks that are harder to see. The most common tick that we've got is far and away the dog tick. It is about the size of a if it has attached and started sucking blood. So it's usually pretty easy to find on you. But definitely showering when you get home from a trip out to, you know, state parks or something like that will help you know, keep them off of you. For animals, if you take dogs or cats out to enjoy nature with you, it is always important to check with your vet to see if they need any flea and tick medication. I am not a vet, so I do not know if there are any specific diseases for animals that would be transmitted via ticks, but ticks originally started climbing grass in order to latch on to the fur of animals like white-tailed deer. White-tailed deer are far and away the most common wild animal that carry ticks. And so they latch on to fur. So making sure that your animal is well-groomed and that it's not overly shedding will help keep ticks to a minimum. Short-haired animals, like certain breeds of dogs, will not need to worry about ticks as much because they don't have as much hair to latch onto as longer-coated breeds like Great Pyrenees. My Golden Retriever probably has some of the longer hair when it comes to dog breeds. So, and making sure that they are on a consistent flea and tick medication will kill any ticks that end up biting. It won't necessarily prevent them from biting, but it does kill them and minimize discomfort to your animal as well. So if you have a tick on you, you want to make sure that you remove it as soon as possible. The longer that a tick is embedded, the more likely it is that they transmit any diseases they might carry. As I mentioned before, the disease prevalence compared to the total tick population is very low, but you definitely want to play it safe if you do have a tick on you, especially if it's over 24 hours. You want to keep an eye on where the tick was embedded to make sure that rashes do not form. It is usually worth, if not going into the doctor, at least consulting with your doctor's office to see if you need to be put on any antibiotics. All four major diseases that are caused by tick bites are going to be bacterial, so antibiotics will be effective. And usually you're on that for about 2 weeks if you do end up with a tick-borne disease. So you've got the tick on you, and it has bit. You want to use a pair of tweezers to grab as close to the skin as possible and just pull out. The tick is not usually killed by crushing because it has a very hard armored shell around its abdomen. So usually you're going to want to flush those down the toilet so that they do not come back. You can't crush a tick and think that it's taken care of. So it is a very, very common to develop a mosquito bite-like rash that starts itching at the location where the tick was embedded. And sometimes that is because there are mouth parts from the tick that are left embedded in your skin. You don't get the entire mouth piece out of your skin. But usually that's going to be because, much like mosquitoes, they inject a chemical to keep you from feeling the bite. The chemical keeps you from feeling the bite. And when the tick is removed, suddenly your immune response kicks in because it recognizes that that chemical shouldn't be there. And so you get, you know, moderate swelling and itchiness, much like a mosquito bite would be. And that is very normal. That's not a sign of any particular disease. And that usually goes away after a couple of days. So that's not something to be alarmed about. If you do have tick problems in your yard or garden, for example, keeping the grass mowed very short is one good way to minimize tick impacts on you and your family. You will have wildlife like birds and possums come in if you have a significant food source for them, which ticks usually are. So if you can keep the grass mowed short, that's going to expose the ticks for predation by other wildlife. There are also chemicals you can spray. Unlike insecticides, and this is a totally pedantic terminology that I am prone to pedanticness at times, tick killers are known as acaricides. A lot of insecticides that you can spray will also be labeled for ticks, but it is important to check the label before buying a product to make sure that it is labeled to kill what you want to kill. Because if it's not labeled, it has either been tested and shown to be ineffective at killing that particular species, or it has not been tested, and you might be getting a product that can kill what you're trying to kill, but you also might not be. So those are just some basic nuggets of information on ticks and how to minimize your minimize negative experiences with them.
Hey, good deal on that, Jesse. And any thoughts on, you know, what is, I mean, I know spring right now, this seems to be kind of our peak as far as the ticks go. Once it gets warmer, are we going to see the tick population decrease? What's kind of the life cycle of these critters?
You know, most of the time, they are going to be most active in early summer. But with the way that the weather has been and the way that's been affecting everything around us, I could not make any confident predictions about how the year is going to go in terms of the life cycle of insects or things like that. It has been absolutely crazy for the last 365 days, whether it's with plants or with bugs. So we are going to be seeing, if I had to guess, we're going to be seeing some very odd life cycle behaviors from a bunch of different insects. Last year, we saw it a lot with grasshoppers. The grasshopper population was completely out of control. And so far this year, it seems to be with ticks. So if they are just showing up earlier in the year and then going through their life cycle more quickly and dying back sooner, I would not be totally opposed to that. It just means that we are shifting the timeline forward by about a month or two compared to what we usually see.
Well, we are certainly living in some interesting times, Jesse, that is for sure. And if people have any questions on this or any other topics I know that you've talked about in the past, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Yeah, they can call any of our extension offices, or if they're in a different state and want to get in touch with their own county office, their extension office will know more about their particular pests in the area. My extension office number is 620-724-8233. I did just think of one final thing I wanted to let people know because of the agriculture in our area. So there is one species of tick called the Lone Star tick, and that is not a tick from Texas. It's a tick that has one white spot on its abdomen. It's very easy to see because the rest of the body is brown. That tick has been responsible for transmitting red meat allergies. So we're talking, if you eat a burger or a steak and have been bitten by this tick, there is a chance that you could go into a very serious allergic reaction, possibly even anaphylactic shock. Now, the only way that that can happen is if the Lone Star tick individual that ends up on you has bitten a cow or another source of red meat previously, before it latched onto you. So what ends up happening is when it latches onto the animal, it ends up consuming and ingesting protein from that animal along with the blood. And those proteins, when you are bitten by that same tick, are recognized as invaders by your immune system. And so you are induced into an allergic reaction by the protein anytime that you ingest it. So I know a lot of people like red meat, and a lot of people would be very, very sad if they ended up with a red meat allergy. The good news is that it is not permanent. It will dissipate after time. It usually takes 3 to 5 years, so you would need to find different sources of meat to eat for that period of time. But that is something for people to know. If they end up with that exact species of tick on them that they could go into an allergic reaction eating red meat. And that's something to be aware of because, you know, if you end up eating red meat alone and you do have that allergic reaction, that can be potentially life-threatening. So that's something you want to avoid if possible.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that, Jesse. And yeah, that would be not fun at all. I would not enjoy that one bit. So I know most of our listeners would be in that same boat. So I do appreciate you sharing all that information. And we're just going to have to tough it out here with this crazy tick season. But yeah, like I said, we're living in a very interesting time. So I do appreciate Jesse joining us and sharing all that good information for us this morning.
Yeah, you have a good day, James.
All right, you take care. That is our horticulture agent, Jesse Gilmore, here on the Mighty 690. We do appreciate our chats with him. And we got Open Line coming up next here. So keep it here on KGGF.